Hello, and welcome to Grand Dukes of the West, episode 32, The Bridge of Montereau. In July of 1418, John the Fearless finally returned to Paris in triumph after leaving the capital in the aftermath of the Cabochois Uprising back in 1413. But despite taking Paris, the Civil War continued, and John always needed more money and men. Richard Vaughan wrote, quote, "The easy exploitation of French resources, which John the Fearless had enjoyed in the years before August 1413, was no longer even possible. Now the bitter memories of civil war in the intervening years, the open violence of both sides, the fragrant duplicity of almost everyone concerned, had brought about a deeply and bitterly divided France." And while the Duke of Burgundy now controlled Paris, his enemies, the Armagnac faction, were now reforming under the new leadership of the Dauphin. Charles, Dauphin of France, had been spirited out of the capital on the eve of the Burgundian takeover by the Breton knight Tanguy du Châtel. The 15-year-old Crown Prince of France made his way south of the Loire River to the Duchy of Berry, and towards the end of June 1418, he issued a proclamation to Armagnac-aligned France, where he told of the Burgundian seizure of Paris. He went on to say, quote, "We let you know of these things, dearest and well-beloved, in order to keep you truthfully informed, and, what is more important, to keep you always in your good loyalty, and also so that as true and loyal subjects, you will be ready in love and unity together to serve, succor, and aid my lord the king with us and in our aid, without obeying anyone except us, acting on behalf of the king. For we are his only son, heir and successor to the crown, to whom, by reason and natural right, belongs the responsibility for governing and administering this kingdom while my lord the king is thus detained and kept in custody. Because the aforesaid rebels have murdered the chancellor and seized our great seal and the king's, which they can abuse at their will, we forbid you to obey any letters or writs sent to you whatsoever, except our own, sealed with our privy seal, and signed with our own hand. Essentially, don't believe the agents of the Duke of Burgundy or my mother. My father is not in control, and I am his true representative." The Dauphin claimed the royal authority which had been delegated to him when the Armagnacs controlled Paris, and set up a government of his own in Bourges, much like the Duke of Burgundy and the Queen had done in Troyes earlier that year. Armagnac ministers, civil servants, and nobles all flocked to Bourges to the Dauphin's new court. Many of them had fled Paris in the wake of the Burgundian takeover, and many had been dismissed from their posts as the Duke of Burgundy and the Queen purged Armagnacs from the royal administration. And along with the administrators came military men. Before long, the Dauphin had a small army under his command and was able to occupy a number of positions outside of Paris in a strategic reverse of the previous year. So now let's go back to Paris. The city had been in somewhat of a rough position recently. The Burgundian encirclement of the capital, combined with the heavy-handed repression and high taxation of the Armagnacs, had damaged the city's economy and caused prices to skyrocket. And now, even with the Burgundians in charge, many of these issues lingered. The tight-fisted control of the Armagnacs had given way, but with the Dauphin's forces now blockading the city, the economy was unable to recover. While much of the blame for this situation did fall on the Armagnacs turned Dauphinists, the buck now did stop at the Duke of Burgundy, so John had to be sensitive to the mood of the capital. In the late summer of 1418, many of the radicals in Paris had worked themselves up into a frenzy and began to make their way to the prisons of the city, with the goal of repeating the massacres of the previous June. The prisons had been restocked over the past few months and were once again full of Armagnac political prisoners, so a good few died before the Duke of Burgundy approached the mob. John was greeted warmly by the leaders of the mob, but as most of his Burgundian soldiers were occupied in Normandy and in operations against the Dauphin, he did not want to test his popularity by opposing their aims. John let the mob continue in their bloodlust for a time, but managed to convince them to turn their attention to an Armagnac garrison near Paris. While the radicals were away from the city, John took the opportunity to forge an alliance with the burghers of the city and formed a militia of more well-to-do Parisians, similar to the National Guard during the French Revolution, or to Louis of Guienne's militia in 1413. John and the bourgeois militia moved to secure the city while the radicals were away. After the mob returned to Paris, the Duke of Burgundy and his middle-class allies were able to take charge and force the mob to disband. Now, much more in control of the capital and somewhat distanced from the radicals, John arrested and executed some of the radical leaders. One of these leaders had formerly served as an executioner himself, and reportedly gave some pointers to his replacement as his head was laid on the block. In doing this, the Duke of Burgundy burned some of his credit with the radicals, but he did gain more control over Paris, and some popularity amongst the better off. But John's control of the capital wouldn't count for much, with both the Dauphin and the King of England in opposition. One of them would have to be allied with, and the other would have to be defeated. Henry V had continued his advance into Normandy and was now besieging Rouen, the capital of the duchy. Shortly before the siege began, the citizens of Rouen had declared for the Duke of Burgundy and kicked out their Armagnac officers. So unfortunately for them, when they reached out to the Dauphin for aid, they were told that none would be coming. Therefore, the Duke of Burgundy received a series of increasingly desperate appeals for help from the Norman capital. John the Fearless sent a small force to help the Rouennais, but he did not have the men to relieve the siege while he was fending off attacks from the Dauphin. So in the fall of 1418, a peace conference was organized between agents of the Duke of Burgundy and the Dauphin. The Dauphin's court was divided on what to do. Many of his advisors were fervently anti-Burgundian and wanted to avoid anything which might solidify John the Fearless's position. But there were also members of the court, such as the young counts of Alençon and Anjou, whose lands had been conquered or were under threat from the English, and so considered Henry V a much bigger threat. John V of Brittany once again presided over the talks, where it was decided that both princes would withdraw their garrisons, the Dauphin would join the royal council, and that appointments to royal office would be managed by a bipartisan commission. Furthermore, a joint military force would be mustered to relieve the siege of Rouen. But in the end, the Dauphin refused to ratify the peace. The hardliners in his court, unwilling to allow the crown prince to fall under the sway of the Duke of Burgundy, won out. But to be fair to the hardcore anti-Burgundians, this likely was John's aim in bringing the Dauphin back to Paris. Jonathan Sumption writes, quote, "By providing for the Dauphin to return to the fervishly partisan atmosphere of the royal court, it would remove the impressionable youth from the influence of the strong-willed men who had surrounded him for the past year, and place him in the orbit of the Queen and the Duke of Burgundy." The Dauphin was the Armagnac's ticket to power, and they were not ready to give him up. It is easy to accuse these men of sinking any hope of civil peace in order to protect their jobs and their power. Plenty of people said this at the time. But the Dauphin's counselors were not alone. Behind them stood many thousands of more modest men who regarded John the Fearless as a usurper, a tyrant, a demagogue, and a murderer, and could not bring themselves to deal with him. So with the Dauphin refusing to cooperate and the situation in Rouen getting ever more desperate, John decided to deal with the English alone. The arrière-ban, or general summons, was proclaimed, as John hoped to rally more men to his side for the defense of Normandy. However, as the kingdom was divided, so many men were already engaged in warfare, and the government was still broke, the arrière-ban only ended up producing a middling force. The Duke of Burgundy thus decided that some taxes would have to be raised, given the desperate situation. But all of his anti-tax rhetoric meant that he could not hope to proclaim a new tithe or land tax, the most effective way of raising royal funds. Instead, a new tax on wine was proclaimed, coins were further debased, and forced loans were imposed on civil servants. With more funds now available, John was able to raise about 4,000 men for the relief of Rouen by the end of November. But this would still not be enough, so the Duke of Burgundy moved from Paris to the front line of the English advance, where he attempted to gather more men, money, and supplies. The Duke of Burgundy was drawing from an ever-shrinking stock. According to Richard Vaughan, quote, "The whole of northeast France in the autumn of 1418 experienced chaos, turmoil, and deprivation. Those contending for power concentrated their energies on fighting, negotiating, or raising support for themselves, and the civil administration of the country, good government, and justice were neglected or abandoned." While John was gathering his strength, the Dauphin had entered into negotiations with the English. In these negotiations, the Dauphin was represented by our old friend and John's old enemy, Louis de Chalons, ex-Count of Tonnerre. The English demanded, as always, the lands ceded in the Treaty of Brittany, as well as Normandy, Anjou, Maine, Flanders, and Touraine. De Chalons and the other Dauphinist ambassadors countered with an offer of the Brittany lands, Normandy, and John the Fearless's northern territories. But the English were not willing to give an inch, and would further only accept their demanded lands with full sovereignty. While the King of England was also facing money and supply issues, he saw that his negotiating position would likely only grow stronger as both the Burgundians and Dauphinists grew more desperate. And a conference was planned for the next month, where Henry would continue his negotiations with the Duke of Burgundy. So he still had the option of playing the factions off one another. Henry V, therefore, had little incentive to scale back his demands, and the negotiations with the Dauphin thus ended. With no hope of Dauphinist aid in the relief of Rouen, a distinct lack of money in his coffers, reports of planned attacks into Burgundy, and his forces still outnumbered by the English, John gave up on his plan to raise the siege. In January of 1419, he sent word to the city that no aid would be coming, and shortly after, the leaders of Rouen began negotiations to surrender. The surrender of Rouen was a humiliation for the Duke of Burgundy, and it also heralded the collapse of all remaining resistance to the English in Normandy. And unfortunately for John the Fearless, the loss of Normandy to the English came along with news of the loss of Languedoc in the far south. As Languedoc was so far from Paris, much of the partisan hatred between the Armagnacs and Burgundians did not reach it. However, after decades of high taxation from the Duke of Berry, who served as the royal lieutenant for Languedoc, the people were open to John's anti-tax message. John sent Louis de Chalons, not the former Count of Tonnerre, but his cousin, the Prince of Orange, down to try and take control of the region. The Prince of Orange made some initial progress in asserting Burgundian control over Languedoc, but soon hit a wall when the remaining Dauphinists began to regroup and advance. The situation in Languedoc was growing dire, and the people soon began to turn against the Prince of Orange as he tried to raise funds for the Duke of Burgundy, while simultaneously failing to provide protection against the Dauphin's forces or the bandits who were becoming more and more common in the region. The Count of Foix, a regional magnate, managed to leverage the discontent with both factions, and in February of 1419, took control of Languedoc and chased the Burgundians out. But he was no fierce partisan to either side, and managed to get appointed royal lieutenant for Languedoc by both the Dauphin and the Duke of Burgundy. So while the Duke of Burgundy lost Languedoc, he could rest easy knowing that its resources would not be turned against him. The loss of Normandy, on the other hand, was a far more severe setback. John the Fearless's position was seriously shaken by the conquest of Normandy. His official propaganda laid the blame for its fall on the Dauphin's refusal to cooperate, which admittedly did contribute mightily to it. But now that John was in control of the capital, and as Rouen had declared for him, the failure to relieve Rouen lay with the Burgundians. The collapse of negotiations between the Burgundians and the Dauphinists in 1418 had left a bad taste in both parties' mouths, so in early 1419, both resumed negotiations with the King of England. But as had been the case since the beginning of the Civil War, a deal with the English could be quite dangerous. English arms in the service of the Dauphin or the Duke of Burgundy had the potential to definitively swing the balance of power, but it would come at a steep cost. Henry V had made his terms well known. The land ceded in the Treaty of Brittany and the lands of the old Angevin Empire ceded with full sovereignty. Acquiescing to these terms would thoroughly undermine domestic support, possibly to the point where the other side could unite France under them. So in all English negotiations, whether with the Armagnacs or the Burgundians, there were two possibilities. The first was that Henry V could be convinced to roll back his demands, something which seemed less likely with each new conquest. And the second was to use the English negotiations to put pressure on the other party. From the English perspective, the fact that both sides were unwilling to give in to their demands was incredibly annoying. But the fact of the matter was that Henry needed help if he wanted to continue his conquests. As I said earlier, the King of England was facing both manpower and money issues. While his army was the strongest concentrated in France, reinforcements were not forthcoming, and the Norman campaign was already the longest foreign campaign in English history up to that point. For Henry V, an alliance with either the Dauphin or the Duke of Burgundy would be necessary to consolidate and continue his gains. He could wait, but not forever. These negotiations between the English and the Dauphin went about the same as in the previous year, so Charles began looking outside of France and England for allies. Specifically, he looked to call upon France's most natural anti-English ally, Scotland. There's a long history of Franco-Scottish cooperation that goes back to the 1200s, but the Scots had thus far not taken a decisive position in the Armagnac-Burgundian Civil War. Individual Scottish companies had joined both John the Fearless and the Count of Armagnac on various campaigns, but the Kingdom of Scotland and the Dauphin sided definitively with each other in February of 1419. This alliance was a major win and would allow the Dauphin to put additional pressure both on the English and on the Duke of Burgundy. And to follow that aim, the Dauphin soon began a new thrust into Burgundian positions around Paris. The Duke of Burgundy had not resided in the capital for a while now, and instead had set up at Provence, about 50 miles or 80 kilometers southwest of Paris. Along with the Duke of Burgundy was the king, queen, and the royal court. The people of Paris were anxious for the return of the royal family, and understandingly believed that the Duke of Burgundy had abandoned them, since, you know, he kinda did. So as the Dauphin cut off the city from the Burgundians, he also sent envoys to see if he could flip the capital. Paris was not willing to abandon the Duke of Burgundy just yet, but emissaries from the city did make it known to John the Fearless that the capital wanted peace and might not be able to hold out against both the Dauphin and the English. So yet another peace conference between the Burgundians and the Dauphinists was set up, which did establish a 3-month truce, but nothing else could be agreed upon. John the Fearless was set to begin in-person negotiations with Henry V in the next few weeks, and was thus unwilling to promise much at this point. Around this time, Henry V found out about the Dauphin's Scottish alliance when the Dauphin unilaterally ended their latest round of negotiations in the end of March. This proved to be the last time that Henry attempted to negotiate with Charles, and so going forward, he would focus on trying to secure a Burgundian alliance. The peace conference between John, Henry V, and Queen Isabeau opened in late May in the town of Moulins, a little ways down the Seine from Paris. The town, which lay on the frontier of the English occupation, was not far from the capital. In fact, it was about twice as close to Paris as John's headquarters in Provence, a gloomy sign of Henry V's progress. The conference opened with Henry V and his brothers meeting with Queen Isabeau, Princess Catherine, who, if everything went right, would soon become Queen of England, and John the Fearless. After some courtly pleasantries and the initial ceremonies, everyone got down to business. And once the serious business of negotiation began, all of the roadblocks of the past negotiations came back. As always, Henry V wanted the lands from the Treaty of Brittany and his conquests ceded to him with full sovereignty. And while John the Fearless and the Queen seemed willing to give up the lands, it was only as a fief. There were doubts that it was even legally possible to alienate these lands from France. Some things did come easier. Henry V was willing to give up on his claim to the crown of France, and the negotiations for the hand of Catherine went fairly smoothly. But the thornier issues dominated the discussions, which began to drag on. When the conference began, the Earl of Warwick stated that he wished negotiations to take 8 days, and in the end, the conference took well over a month. All the while, there were two competing lines of thought in the Burgundian camp. The first was championed by Nicolas Roland. Remember that name, Nicolas Roland. Roland argued that a deal should be struck with the English right now, as they seemed to be only growing stronger. If the Duke failed to make an agreement, he risked allowing the English and the Dauphinists to unite. And even if that wasn't the case, Roland did not believe that the Burgundians could drive the English out of France, even with the help of the Dauphin's forces. With every conquest, the English demands would only grow, so making peace now was preferable to making peace later. On the other hand, was the argument that the Burgundians did not have the right to alienate lands from France. And further, as Henry V had succeeded to a usurped throne, threats to the English throne remained. Henry V's position in England was still considered to be somewhat shaky, and if he was driven from the throne, any peace deal would evaporate. Feeding into Burgundian doubts about a peace were Tanguy du Châtel and other Dauphinist ministers. Du Châtel had arrived to the conference in secret and was urging John to continue his negotiations with the Dauphin. For his part, the Duke of Burgundy was open to these entreaties. If we view his negotiations with the English as an attempt to put pressure on the Dauphin, then they obviously succeeded. So, John the Fearless decided to continue his negotiations with the Dauphin, and he sent Nicolas Roland to arrange a meeting. Now, Henry V was not a man who enjoyed having his time wasted, and he had wasted a lot of time in fruitless negotiations with both the Burgundians and the Armagnacs-turned-Dauphinists. Once he heard that John had resumed talks with the Dauphin, the King of England and the Duke of Burgundy exchanged some tense words. "Fair cousin," Henry said, "we wish you to know that we will have the daughter of your king and all that we have asked, or we will drive him and you out of this kingdom." To which John replied, "Sire, you are pleased to say so, but before you can drive my lord and me out of his kingdom, I make no doubt that you will be heartily tired." And a week later, the conference at Moulins broke up, without a peace deal being made. Déjà vu all over again. The next day, John the Fearless was meeting with the Dauphin by the castle of Pouilly-le-Fort. This conference, for once, proved to be somewhat productive. That is not to say that there weren't tensions. In fact, the conference almost broke down, but was salvaged by the Lady of Giac. Giac was a favorite of the Duke of Burgundy, and her brother was a member of the Dauphin's household. She was one of the few people left in France favorably viewed by both Burgundy and the Dauphin, and was also one of the loudest voices calling for peace between the factions. Throughout the week that the counselors and courtiers were traveling between the two opposing camps, the Lady of Giac was meeting with them and urging compromise. It is in large part thanks to her that a preliminary deal was reached, and she also deserves a lot of credit for arranging the conference in the first place. The Peace of Pouilly-le-Fort carried all the classics of the peace deals over the past few years. A general amnesty was proclaimed, seized property would be restored, and a commission would be created to sort out the rivals and redundancies in the twin administrations and armies. Charles and John pledged friendship with each other and promised to work together in the governance of the realm, and to begin raising an army to fight the English. This peace looked like it would actually be implemented, and throughout France, people on both sides of the conflict were jubilant. The years of civil war had only brought ruin to the kingdom, and most people were ready to move on and unite. However, this peace deal brought with it some complications. As we explored in the beginning of the episode, many of the Dauphin's closest counselors were hard-line anti-Burgundians, and they were unwilling to allow the prince to fall under the influence of John the Fearless. As the Peace of Pouilly-le-Fort required the Dauphin to return to the royal council, this was a distinct possibility, and many of these hardliners began working to convince the Dauphin to back out of the deal. But we shouldn't see the Duke of Burgundy as negotiating in purely good faith. All throughout the conference, he maintained open diplomatic channels with the English, and he would never have agreed to a deal if he didn't think he could count on his ability to influence the Dauphin once everyone was back under one roof. Even with all of these reservations, and the fact that the terms of the peace were left deliberately vague to the point where further negotiations would be necessary to iron out all the complications, a civil peace seemed as close to possible as it had been since before the death of Louis of Guienne. Certainly, the King of England thought so, as when he learned of the Peace of Pouilly-le-Fort, he finally broke off negotiations with the Duke of Burgundy. A few days later, English forces stormed the town of Pontoise, the town where the king had been staying during the negotiations at Moulins. Apart from the no doubt satisfying symbolic victory that the seizure of Pontoise represented, the town guarded a strategically important crossing of the Oise River, and its fall meant that the English were now one step closer to being able to march on Paris. The Duke of Burgundy and the royal family, minus the Dauphin, had been encamped in Saint-Denis when they heard of the fall of Pontoise. Not liking how exposed their current position was, they headed for Troyes in Champagne. Paris was abandoned to its fate, with the young Philip of Saint-Pol, a son of the late Anthony of Brabant, left in charge of the city for the Burgundians. From Pontoise, the English began raiding into the Ile-de-France and Picardy while they finished mopping up in Normandy. It was clear that the next phase of their advance into France would begin shortly. Throughout the next month, as the English reached further into France, arrangements to implement the Peace of Pouilly-le-Fort were ongoing, but tensions between the Dauphinists and the Burgundians were re-emerging. The English raids were met with disunited resistance, and neither side wanted to vacate fortifications to the other. Even with these stumbling blocks, neither side was quite willing to give up on the peace, and preparations for a united French counteroffensive continued. So too did negotiations between the parties, with the Duke of Burgundy trying to get the Dauphin to join him, and the Dauphin's counselors trying to prevent that. Tanguy du Châtel proposed that the Dauphin send a delegation to the royal council instead of attending in person, but the Duke of Burgundy refused the compromise. It looked like the Duke of Burgundy had forced the Dauphin and his counselors into a corner. All of France was now anxious to put the Peace of Pouilly-le-Fort into effect, and reneging on the deal could fatally undermine the Dauphin's support. But at the same time, if the Dauphin were to join the king's royal council in person, the Dauphinist cause would evaporate, and the raison d'etre for Charles's regency would be gone. The anti-government in Bourges would necessarily be dismantled, and many Dauphinist officers would have to yield to Burgundian ones. And although I've been using the term Dauphinist, this party was still largely the old Armagnac party, and many of these men were unwilling to agree to any arrangement which left the Duke of Burgundy in power, much less one where he would have the chance to dominate the young prince and the joint government. But the Dauphin's court wasn't united in their opposition to the peace. For every hardcore Armagnac in Bourges, there was a counselor who had simply chosen to follow the Dauphin over the Duke. Many of these men had been receiving offers from the Duke of Burgundy for positions in the new joint government. This was in part a move towards the reconciliation established in the peace, but also a move to maximize the Duke of Burgundy's influence over the new government by establishing the value of his patronage early on. With pressure for a settlement rising, the ultras in the Dauphin's camp began planning to take drastic measures. In their mind, one man in particular was standing in the way of peace, and he would need to be taken out. A meeting between the Dauphin and the Duke of Burgundy had been planned for late August in the town of Montereau-Fouillon. Montereau was situated right at the confluence of the Seine and Yonne rivers, and the appointed meeting place between the Duke and Dauphin was to be a bridge spanning the Yonne. It was there that the Dauphin and his counselors planned to put an end to the Duke of Burgundy. However, the conspirators in the Dauphin's camp might not have been as subtle as they thought, because rumors had reached John the Fearless that a plot against his life was brewing. The appointed day of the meeting came and went with the Duke of Burgundy still in Troyes. It was the Lady of Giac, the most consistent voice for peace over the past year, who finally convinced John the Fearless to go to Montereau. The Duke of Burgundy arrived at the fortress of Montereau-Fouillon, which was across the river from the town, on the 10th of September, 1419, with about 100 men. The Dauphin had lent the castle of Montereau to John the Fearless to use as a base in the coming negotiations. An enclosure had been built on the bridge of Montereau, and both the Duke and the Dauphin were to enter with only 10 men. Before the parties entered the enclosure, each swore oaths of peace and friendship. As the Duke of Burgundy and his party entered the enclosure, the door was locked behind them. John then approached the Dauphin, doffed his cap, and kneeled to greet the prince. Charles then raised John to his feet, and the two princes of the fleur-de-lis began chatting. As John and Charles were exchanging their greetings, one of the Dauphin's counselors, Jean Louvet, whispered something in the prince's ear. This was the signal. Tanguy du Châtel grabbed his axe and swung it at the Duke of Burgundy. Shouts of "Kill!" soon rang from the enclosure, and Dauphinous soldiers ran into it from the unlocked door on their side. Burgundian soldiers, hearing the commotion, tried to force their way into the melee, but the enclosure was too sturdy. All the while, they were being peppered by arrows fired from Dauphinous archers hiding in a nearby building. After a brief skirmish, John the Fearless lay dead, and most of the men he had entered the enclosure with were either dead or taken by the Dauphin's forces. Louis of Orléans had finally been avenged. One of the assassins, an old Orléanist, was said to have yelled, "You cut off my master's hand, I'll cut off yours." But while John's death must have been satisfying for the Orléanists surrounding the Dauphin, as is said of the execution of the Duke of Enghien, it was worse than a crime. It was a mistake. And many of the Dauphin's supporters knew this. Robert Lemasson, a close counselor of the prince, had been seen in a heated discussion with the Dauphin the morning of the assassination. The Dauphin dismissed his arguments and turned away, calling for Lemasson to follow. However, Lemasson turned and walked the other way. He passed by another of the Dauphin's counselors and told him, quote, "I'm very much afraid that he's been wickedly advised, and that he'll do something today which will be very damaging, both to him and to his kingdom." Several histories of the meeting at Montereau claim innocence for the Dauphin. They argue that either a scuffle had been started by the Duke of Burgundy, or that the Dauphin's ministers had arranged the whole thing behind his back. But Richard Vaughan dedicates a whole chapter of his book on John the Fearless to analyzing the events at and around the Bridge of Montereau, where he convincingly argues for the Dauphin's guilt. One person who is also blamed, but unfairly so, for the Duke of Burgundy's death was the Lady of Giac. Everyone knew that she had been the one to convince John the Fearless to go to Montereau, but she had no motive to urge him to his death. Giac was a champion of peace, and she would have been smart enough to know that the murder of the Duke of Burgundy would not bring that peace. But in the aftermath of the deed, she was incredibly unpopular among the Burgundians for her perceived role, and ended up defecting to the Dauphin out of fear for her safety. The murder of John the Fearless proved to be a decisive turning point in the course of the Burgundian story. John and his father Philip considered themselves to be French princes first and foremost, and their first priority was always affairs in France. John's son, Philip the Good, will not ignore France, but he will begin to identify as more self-consciously Burgundian. And he will see out what his father could never bring himself to do. He will forsake the French crown and fully ally with the English. The legacy of the second Valois Duke is hard to pin down. He was responsible for over a decade of civil war, and it's easy to claim that his life and rule was a detriment to the Kingdom of France. But from a Burgundian rather than a French perspective, he was an effective leader and a capable military commander. he continued to strengthen and expand the Burgundian complex of territories and the prestige that the Duke of Burgundy commanded. Richard Vaughan wrote of him, quote, "To call John a French prince and a traitor may be true in some sense, but it is misleading. It is better to recognize him for what he was, the ruler of a complex of territories and rights which belonged to him and to his house. A ruler whose policies, whose unscrupulous methods, whose torturous diplomacy were all aimed at maintaining, and if possible, increasing, his own and his family's power. Whatever he may have been to France, he was a loyal Burgundian." Now that John the Fearless is dead, we enter the era of Philip the Good, where Valois Burgundy arguably reaches its peak. But John's reign has basically been a non-stop race through the narrative of the Civil War. So before we get to Philip the Good, I want to take a little break from the narrative, like I did in the middle of Philip the Bold's reign. I have a few supplemental episodes planned for the next couple of months. Some will dive a bit deeper into topics that I haven't devoted enough attention to, and others will give important context for the coming reign of Philip the Good. I will also be taking the next month off, so it will be 4 weeks until we get there. But for now, I want to leave off with this. A little over 100 years after the assassination, King Francis I, a great-grandson of Louis of Orléans and a great-great-grandson of John the Fearless, was touring the Duchy of Burgundy. Burgundy was once more a possession of the crown of France, but the heir of the Valois Dukes still claimed the title Duke of Burgundy and was itching to reclaim the duchy. Francis was visiting the Charterhouse of Champmol, Philip the Bold's great monument to his dynasty. While there, a monk brought out the skull of John the Fearless, and, pointing to a hole made by a Dauphinus sword, said, "This is the hole through which the English entered France." Thank you so much to my patrons. Christine, now Duchesse de Nemours. Elliot, Graf von Kravenstein. Anthony, Comte de Chateauneuf-en-Auxois. James, Graf von Temse. Preston, Comte de Saint-Fargo. Mark, Comte de Mirceau. Diana, Graf von Biersel. Mehmet, Comte Santerre. Chris, Comte de Semur. David, Graf von Bornum. Rosa, Comte de Germol. Elliot, Comte de Bussy-le-Grand. Quentin, Graf von Blasfeld. And to my Knights of the Duchy. If you want to join them, you can at patreon.com/valoisburgundy. If you want to support the podcast in other ways, you can do so by leaving a review on your podcast app of choice and telling your friends about the show. Both really help to grow the show and will earn you my everlasting appreciation. If you want to keep up with the show, you can follow me at Valois Burgundy on Twitter or Blue Sky, or find Grand Dukes of the West on Facebook. You can also email me at granddukesofthewest@gmail.com and check out the podcast website for maps, images, sources, and more at granddukesofthewest.com. Once again, thank you for listening.